Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans. The congressional panel investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol holds its next public hearing today. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at noon. The hearing will focus on the rioters and mob who stormed the Capitol and the efforts to assemble them. Join us at noon for live NPR coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now we examine landmark Supreme Court decisions this term about religion in public life. The New York Times quoted Supreme Court scholars who say the High Court has become the most pro-religion it's been since at least the 1950s. Roadmap here for our discussion. City of Boston denying a ceremonial City Hall flag-raising request from a Christian group court deemed unconstitutional. The Maine tuition program ruling that the state pays tuition to private schools but not religious schools for rural students court. That amounts to discrimination against religion. And we start with the High Court siding with that former high school football coach fired after leading postgame prayers on the 50-yard line, a case that has really sparked free speech and religion conversations. Join in, 800-642-1234. Annie Laurie Gaylor is co-founder and co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation based in Madison. Annie Laurie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Good morning. Before we dig into these three cases, just some of your takeaways here. You know, the new court has six Republican appointees, three Democratic ones. And with these landmark rulings this term and the court really more laser focused on what, you know, the country's founders thought constitutional protections meant, is originalism a threat to separation between church and state?
Yes, originalism has always been a threat. And I like to call it the Trump court. He made three appointments to this court, which was already twerping to the far right. And those appointments were based on his promises, for example, to overturn Roe versus Wade, and that the court delivered. And we have, at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, have endorsed some kind of court reform or expansion since the time that Merrick Garland's seat was stolen by Mitch McConnell, when President Obama was not allowed to bring his nominee to a hearing. And then we have since seen the rushed appointment of Amy Coney Barrett in the midst of a national election. These are unprecedented manipulations by Mitch McConnell and the Speaker of the House that have... It's in a sense corrupted our court. So we're in deep trouble. We have minority rule on the Supreme Court with so many of these ultra conservatives appointed by presidents who did not win the popular election.
Looking at the Kennedy versus Bremerton School District, the 6-3 decision, court siding in the former high school football coach who lost his job because of his practice of praying after games. What was your reaction to this ruling?
Well, I would say that people should know that Coach Kennedy, who's a Fox Media darling and trumpeted by Trump, was not a coach with much experience, and he decided he wanted to become a football coach because he had personally promised God to give him the glory after every game, win or lose. And he wasn't really fired. He was put on administrative leave because he had continued to do these disruptive prayers after the district had tried to accommodate him in many ways. But he had for years led these students in prayer, the same time and same place. And when the school district took complaints, they stopped that. And so the narrative that went before the U.S. Supreme Court was, in a sense, very deceitful. And he claimed he only wanted to give private prayer. And so, interestingly, the fact that the majority bought this deceitful narrative will be a little bit helpful in preserving the separation of religion and government regarding football prayers in public schools, because he said he just wanted to do private prayer. And that's what the court, the very fact-dependent decision by the court said. that his free expression rights were being denied. He just wanted to do private prayer. So football coaches should be aware that they can't lead students in prayer based on this decision.
You know, a question that comes up in the case is whether a coach who routinely prayed with students, whether they felt coerced into doing that, whether the students felt pressured to pray. What do you make of that tension in the case?
There's no question that if you are a football player, everything depends on pleasing your coach. So, of course, there's the innate coercion there of knowing your coach wants you to pray. And even Kavanaugh had made that point at the oral arguments, although, of course, he was part of the 6-3 majority against it. And what was unusual in this case is that the dissenters, of course, Justice Sotomayor wrote it, joined by Stephen Breyer, who's our outgoing justice, mm-hmm. and Elena Kagan. They corrected the factual record to the point where they submitted photographs of Coach Kennedy praying with students into their dissent. So we have a huge factual disagreement by the court, and they wanted the record to reflect that for years he had prayed with students. When he said he wanted private prayer, that was really not the history of the case. But it is a very shocking decision in that it clearly signals that the majority, the extremist supermajority on our Supreme Court, are ready to start repealing 75 years of firm Supreme Court precedent against religious indoctrination in our public schools. So while this case is not going to be a total game changer in that it deals with so-called private prayer, it is sort of the beginning of the end of so many of these strong protections for the rights of conscience of a captive audience of school children. And at the Freedom From Religion Foundation, 50% of our caseload from the public deals with violations in the public schools, and we are able to invoke this strong precedent against that kind of indoctrination or ritual inflicted on students.
Annie Laurie Gaylor with us, co-president of the Wisconsin-based Freedom From Religion Foundation, as we look at Supreme Court rulings this term and the question, separation of church and state, where it is now. You can join in 800-642-1234. So, you know, something that's come up in this particular case is the Lemon Test, that it put an end to a 1971 precedent known as the Lemon Test to help determine whether a government practice had a secular purpose or whether it violated the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. What do you make of the Lemon Test now and how it's being talked about?
Yes, it was almost just a casual reference that the supermajority threw away the Lemon Test. They simply said a partial sentence, this court long ago abandoned Lemon and its endorsement offshoot. And the Lemon Test codified the principles of separation between church and state expounded by the Supreme Court. It was very simple. It asked whether a government action has a secular purpose, whether it advances or inhibits religion, or whether the act of the government fosters excessive government entanglement between state and church. So this is what they have thrown away, and they're replacing it with what they call it
history and tradition test.
History and tradition test, and which is very vague. It gives public schools really no guidance. And also, it seems to suggest that if there's a precedent of violating the Lemon Test in the past, of violating the idea of separation of church and state, then that creates history, and you're going to go with it. So very dismaying. But the Lemon Test had been not invoked a great deal in court cases. We knew that it was being gunned for. We knew it was probably not going to last. But how insulting to just be almost a footnote in this decision. And we knew Alton Lemon, who took a case against vouchers in Pennsylvania with the ACLU. Alton Lemon was a great man. I was thrilled that the Lemon Test was named for him.
Hmm. Annie Laurie Gaylor leads the Freedom from Religion Foundation as we look at SCOTUS rulings this term, strengthening the role of religion in public life. Chief Justice John Roberts' court siding with religious groups. Is there a pattern here as to what violates the right to exercise faith? Join in on the Supreme Court decisions at the intersection of free speech and religious rights, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the wall between religion and the public sphere and several major decisions of the High Court this term on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, published a commentary last week saying, quote, "The court has adopted an approach that would see the lines between church and state hopelessly blurred, if not eliminated altogether." Join in with your reaction on boundaries between church and state, what these decisions signal to you, 800-642-1234. Annie Laurie Gaylor is co-president of the Freedom from Religion Foundation with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's talk about Carson versus Macon, the court striking down this main program that provided public funding for students to attend private schools but prohibited the use of state money at schools that provided religious instruction. How might this ruling impact school choice in America?
There have been a lot of bad rulings on vouchers. And of course, our state at the state level had some early very bad decisions allowing vouchers to religious schools to be paid for with tax dollars. But what's different with Carson versus Macon? Well, there's two things. In this case, it said that if there's a program giving to secular private entities, schools, tax money for students to attend, that the state must provide the same money for the religious education. Before it was it may. Mm-hmm. So that is a compulsion. The second thing is that it kind of shot down the no aid provision of that state constitution, the no aid to religious schools provision, which many of our state constitutions have. They call it the Blaine Amendment, but it's really based on the religious Declaration of Religious Liberty by Thomas Jefferson that said that no citizen should be compelled to attend, support, or erect a place of worship. So that was a bitter decision. And in it, Justice Sotomayor did point out to the pattern that you have referenced that we are seeing on the current Supreme Court of privileging religion. And in fact, of emphasizing only the free exercise clause at the expense of the establishment clause. And in her dissent, her very strong dissent in this main voucher case, she said that the Supreme Court was essentially saying that it is a violation of the free exercise of religion to say that there is a violation of the establishment clause. That was very blunt and plain spoken. So we're not just seeing a blurring of a line. We are just seeing complete religious privileging by the U.S. Supreme Court.
I wonder how the Free Exercise Clause, as it's seen in this ruling, what does it mean for the future and how the court regards the Free Exercise Clause?
As paramount. And before, they talked about the play in the joint, said that they were a balancing act. And, you know, the Establishment Clause says in the First Amendment, says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And the second part of it was, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And in the 14th Amendment, those rights apply to state citizens. So they're equally important, but one isn't more important than the other. And as my mother, who was the principal founder of the Freedom from Religion Foundation, always said, there can be no true freedom of religion without freedom from religion and government. Because when you have the government favoring religion, then you will always have preferred religion and you will have religions or irreligious views that are turned into outside views, that those people will not have the same rights as the favored religion.
Let's take a call now. Steve with us from Sun Prairie. Steve, what is on your mind?
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. You know, I follow this organization on Facebook, and I do see a lot of the posts that are out there. And it's a huge difference between expression and the endorsement of a religion. And, for example, I've seen posts out there that if you're a government employee and you were across the church or across to work, that by definition that could be establishment. Really, it's nothing but religious bigotry. There's a huge difference between expression by an employee working for government and the establishment or of that particular religion by government.
Steve, thank you for that. Annie Laurie, what is your response to how Steve sees it?
Well, I don't know what post he's talking about. So, you know, there are all kinds of government employees who may wear a religious symbol. So I'm really not quite sure where he's coming from.
I want to just take a moment here as before we go to the next case with Chief Justice John Roberts saying, you know, when state and local governments opt to subsidize private schools, they must allow families to use that public funding to pay for religious schools. And I just want to, because he is the Chief Justice, you know, he's making a very clear point there to schools all over the country, I would imagine, as to how you subsidize or pay for private schooling.
Well, people need to know that the two schools, the parents going to or wanting to go to two religious schools in Maine chose schools that allow complete discrimination. For example, you can't be an LGBTQ parent or teacher. Totally discriminatory. They don't have to take any student they don't want based on religion or religious morality. And this has to now be paid for with public funds. And if the state of Maine doesn't want to do that, they have to stop paying for students to attend secular education. And Maine is a very unusual situation. It's so rural that many of the places in Maine do not have a public school, and that's why they had this special law to help subsidize private schooling for at the high school level. So obviously they need to provide public education of some type, and so they're crippled. They're being told they have to support these religiously segregated and bigoted schools.
Annie Laurie Gaylor with us, co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join in 800-642-1234 in these recent Supreme Court cases. Looking at the unanimous decision in May, the Supreme Court said Boston must allow a Christian group to fly its flag in front of City Hall. You know, it had put up the flags of so many other organizations. How did you read the court's unanimous decision here?
Well, this is a very fact dependent case, but in on the surface, terribly shocking that the court would say you have to fly a Christian flag on one of your flagpoles at City Hall. But the city of Maine is able to avoid this terrible prospect by simply changing its policy. It had primarily used this third flagpole for events that had to do with government-hosted celebrations, and these included Pride Month, and that's really what it had this religious organization asking to fly its flag. It's really anti-LGBTQ, but many of the other flags have been from foreign countries having to do with dignitaries coming to town. So what they've done is changed their policies so that they no longer have basically a public forum on their flagpole. However, very distressing to see this image of a Christian flag in front of the American flag and the state of Massachusetts flag being something that the Supreme Court would have tolerated.
In our final moments together, are there other ways the High Court recently expanded the place of religion in public life that you see as blurring separation between church and state?
Well, of course, we are in crisis in the state of Wisconsin because of the terrible overturning of Roe versus Wade on June 24th by six justices who had all been raised Roman Catholic. Gorsuch has become an Episcopalian, and these are conservative Catholics. And we are seeing ultimately a religious dogma being forced on us by the Supreme Court, the only organized opposition to religion, to abortion, excuse me, is religious in nature. And we had submitted an amicus brief to that effect, showing the religious ideology, the Christian ideology behind the anti-abortion law in Mississippi and so many other places. And now Wisconsin women are suffering because the four clinics have been shuttered. We are seeing, 12 states now, and probably predicted half our states will no longer have reproductive liberty. And that is a problem that is a theocratic decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Annie Laurie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Annie Laurie Gaylor, co-founder and co-president of the Freedom From Religion Foundation based in Madison. News update is next here in the Ideas Network. We are celebrating the concert band season here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is British composer Gustav Holst's first suite in E-flat, perhaps a crowd pleaser at community band performances you've attended. The Association of Concert Bands is an international organization serving adult community bands, nearly 600 member bands in their U.S. ranks listed on their site, 13 in Wisconsin. Join in on municipal and community bands. Maybe you're a member or frequent these concerts, 800-642-1234. Gail Brechting is president of the Association of Concert Bands. In her 25th year as conductor of the West Michigan Concert Winds, was a band director in Michigan at the K-12 and college level for 40 years. Gail, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning from Michigan. Thank you for inviting me. I'm really excited to be here. It's nice to be not too far away, just across the big lake.
Yes, so. Hello, thanks. Neighbor across the big lake. Right.
Exactly. We're waving at each other, right?
Oh, I am so curious what your love and attraction is to community bands. What makes them such a precious part of our society, Gail?
Well, you know, I never thought I would necessarily go on this path. You know, I've been a band director forever, but I got involved as a musician myself in community bands. And it is the place where people who are out doing their own lives, having their own families, come back together for that passion that they've always loved as they probably grew up and got into the bands. Here in America, you know, we have school bands, and that's where a lot of people get that start. And then the communities have allowed for it to be a place that you can get back and enjoy that passion that you had. So community bands are very, very, very big right now, especially. They were big back in the 1800s in Sousa's time, and then they kind of waned for a bit. And now they're really making a huge comeback. And I think it's because people just want to be part of what they had perhaps when they were in high school. That's a joyful time. And that's a lot of people do that. I have people in my band who say, I get back in this group and I'm with my people. They speak my language, you know? And so I think that that's a really important part of it. But it based out of what's important in the community, you know, it goes back for quite a ways back historically. I think it was something that businesses or corporations or companies did back in the 1800s to give their people that worked, you know, in their company for years and years, something to do in the evening, long before even radio or TV or computers or Spotify. You know, it was something to do. And I believe that's where it got started. Yes. And it was an important part and a great deal of pride. Many of them were named after their city or their town. And so there was a great deal of pride. And sometimes even after that company that started them, there's a group in England called the Black Dyke Brass Band. And it was the Black Dyke, I believe it was a mining company. So, and that transferred to America when all of the, you know, immigration happened. So that's where it kind of started in regards to that. But as far as you said, it just forms a wonderful community for people who like to do this. You know, it's like, it's like going bowling or bridge clubs or, you know, things like that. It's an interest, that common interest.
It makes me curious about their ranks today, because we've seen volunteer rates for charity organizations on the decline. How is the Association of Concert Bands recruiting members, or how do you see membership in these, you know, community bands? How do they stay vibrant?
Right. Well, it's almost the opposite of what you just said about volunteering on the decline. We have seen, and I've been involved with this organization for maybe 20 years total, being on the board and you know, in organization that needs help here and there. I've been involved and then became president 2 years ago. But the thing that we've noticed is we are on the upswing with community bands. It's almost the opposite. It's people wanting to do something, again, that has that worth to them singularly by themselves. They want to do something, but they want to do it with a group. And so we've seen many new upstart bands coming out of the outgrowth of a city, you know, out in these suburbans. There might be in a city the size of, let's say, Chicago, there might be 100 community bands, you know.
Wow.
they're all over. Yeah.
We're talking about concert and community bands with the president of the Association of Concert Bands, Gail Brechting, conductor in Michigan, previous band director in public schools for more than 40 years. You can join in on community bands, maybe one you're a part of, the ones you love to go to, those concerts in the summer, 800-642-1234. Gail, you mentioned Sousa, and we want to play one of the more popular city band songs. This is John Philip Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever, performed by the U.S. Marine Band. Yes, we know it well. Why does this resonate with Americans?
Well, it resonates because, first of all, the title, Stars and Stripes Forever, it was written to describe our flag, which is an important thing. And in 1987, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, in 1987, there was a move to have a national march. And so there were petitions that went out. I know they were around here in my communities. We got it out to the people. They had to sign it just like anything else that would happen in a vote. And it was named the National March of the United States of America. It is actually officially our march, which that in itself, I think, says something very great about the music. And then there's a funny little story. If we have time, I want to tell it.
Sure.
This used to be called the Disaster March, because I know. I didn't think that was so great until I heard why. In circus bands, and those people who remember going to circuses, they were live little bands that played for all the music, and they had signals. And one of the signals was, if there was truly a disaster, like a fire or something that we had to get the people out of the circus tent, this was the march that was played. And it was a signal to get everybody out.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's this march. Isn't that interesting? I didn't like the title of it, especially when it became the national march, but I thought that was an interesting fact about this particular march.
Sousa was also known for leading the U.S. Marine Band for a dozen years in the late 1800s. What is the significance of the U.S. Marine Band?
There's a lot of significance to the U.S. Marine Band or any of the big military bands. They show us what the quality of an ensemble can be. People that are in these bands all pretty much have their master's degree in that instrument that they play. It used to be you could audition and just get into the band. Now you pretty much have to have a degree from a university in your performance instrument to be able to be in these bands. But the thing that they do is they serve our country in good times and in bad times. They are something that helps the people feel better about life, to go on perhaps the charge of having to fight, or you know, in the sad times when we have to bury someone. If you think about it, there's almost always a band there or music there of some sort. So music serves as, you know, that wonderful cushion to all of us for all the things in our lives. And that's why we still have military bands, because it is so true that it's important to all humans to have something to help cushion that blow.
Let's take a call now. Emily joining us from Mount Horeb. Emily, you were a member of a community band, or are?
Yes, that's correct. I was in the Verona area community band, mm-hmm. and I was in that for a number of years before the pandemic started. I'm kind of slowly getting back into live performing just out of precaution, but I think it's just a wonderful organization to have available to the community. I've met so many wonderful people. They had a great repertoire of music, and it was something I did music throughout college, but it's not my career. And just being able to have that opportunity to continue doing something after I was out of college, it made the transition into the workforce a lot better. It just made my heart so happy to be able to share music with people who are passionate like I was.
What do you play?
I play flute, and I didn't do this in a community band, but I also play violin as well.
Oh, wow. Emily, thank you. Gail, go ahead.
Yes, I was just going to ask the same thing, what instrument she played. And that's fantastic. And that says it right there, Emily. It's so important that I've had students come out of universities and find our my band or any band that's that the ability to go and find a band is on our ACB website. Find a band, it's called. And that part of it is great for these kids coming out of college who might have played in college bands. And it allows them, again, to find people that are of like thought and interest. And it allows them to get to come into the adult world and doing something they feel real comfortable with. So I'm glad. Thank you, Emily, for sharing that.
Emily, who took a hiatus for a bit during the pandemic, how has the pandemic affected these bands as you look across America?
Yeah, it's been interesting to be in the arts through the pandemic. Many, many bands, of course, we were just shut down, as everybody was. Some of the bands were shut down and still are just coming back, like Emily was saying. Some bands made virtual songs, and what they did is each individual person was given their part and had to record it and then send it in, and then it was edited and put together. I know many bands that did that, but you had to have people with skills to do that. And then there are groups that are coming back slowly. One of the things we had to do was there was a big study on all the aerosol, how it was affecting people within the room as they were playing. And it was University of Colorado that did this big study. There was also one out in Maine that did this study. ACB was involved with that study, and it allowed school bands, college bands, community bands to be able to safely do something during that pandemic time. And we had to be 6 to 8 feet apart. We all had to have masks on over our instruments as well as our faces, and be in a huge room. It was very difficult because that's not how it is. That's not how it's set up. So as we've been able to get outside more and do things, last summer was a glorious summer because we all got to go outside and play and not have all this paraphernalia on us and our instruments. But then we had to come back in, and Omicron hit, and then we had to go back into that other style. So a lot of groups just said, I don't want to deal with that. And many groups are just coming back. I don't think we really lost too many. I know there are some that did go defunct because they just couldn't afford to do things, and that's sad. But I think they'll start to come back. I think we'll start to see a resurgence of them in the next couple of years. So.
Gail Brechting with us leads the Association of Concert Bands, supporting adult concert community municipal bands across the U.S. and the world. Join in on what these bands mean to your community. A shout out to Verona, Fort Atkinson, West Bend, Eau Claire, 800-642-1234. This is another John Philip Sousa song, Wisconsin Forward Forever. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Moving right now. This is Leroy Anderson's Bugler's Holiday, part of the repertoire of city band performances. On the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with the head of the Association of Concert Bands. Gail Brechting is here about the role of community bands. And I want to give a shout out to the Lake Harriet Band Shell in Minneapolis and all the city bands that have performed there when I was growing up, that tradition is so fervent, even today as it was a half century ago. And I was looking at some of these bands formed way over 100 years ago. Join in on your memories, 800-642-1234. Gail is with us for about 9 more minutes. Gail, what are your fondest memories of attending municipal or community band concerts? What sticks out in your mind?
Well, I have to say that I was involved with community bands and orchestras growing up in the Petoskey area. A lot of it was during holiday times, and that was always fun. We had a great high school program, so we drew a lot of students out of it as well as adults. And then I got involved just playing. I'm a trombone player. I went to Central Michigan University, and I got my degree there and things, and I've played in them, and that was joyful. We did all kinds of fun things. You know, we were in parades, and we did concerts, and we would go to nursing homes, and we would do things to really aid our community. And then I got involved with conducting one. And so, you know, as you get involved, and then I got involved with the Association of Concert Bands, and here I am the president. You know,
it kind of snowballed just a little bit.
It did. How your path takes you. I am going to be coming over to Wisconsin. I have a daughter that goes to Marquette University. I'm coming. Yes, and she's in the PA program there. But I'm coming over in August because I'm going to be giving an award to Dr. Fonder up in Appleton, Wisconsin, from the Association of Concert Bands. He received our Mentor Ideal Award for being such a fine educator and also community band person. And so I'm coming over to, and so for Appleton people in that area, I'm going to be there on August 2nd, I believe, for a concert with the community band in Appleton, and love to see you if you're up there. You know, come up and say hi if you heard us on the radio today.
I love that. Yes.
Yeah.
Let's take another call. Jean joining us from Madison. Jean, hi.
Oh, hi. Well, you're just bringing back memories, and it's still a current band. It's our neighborhood Westmoreland Walking Band in Madison, and started by Julie Verbin, music director in the school system, and it's just a fabulous little band. The main performances are the neighborhood 4th of July parade, and then there's a Halloween parade that kind of goes in the other direction from the church parking lot to the park and back, and it's just adorable, and kids join it. They can be, you know, middle school just learning their instruments. They usually have one practice, and then they perform, and it always sounds great, and it's just a hit. You know, older adults come back, and it's just a lot of fun.
Jean, do you participate?
My daughter did. Yeah,
okay.
We were always there. She was a flute player, and it was fun. And even after she was out of school, she kept going whenever she could. And then when they get to the park, they play some songs for the flag-raising ceremony, and it's quite adorable.
Oh, I love that tradition, and it really, Gail, sounds like this brings together a neighborhood.
Oh, absolutely. And these are the things that you see, and you see community bands oftentimes can be children all the way up to 90-year-olds and older. I mean, one of the gentlemen in my band was 90 years old, was still playing. We have many people in the community bands throughout the nation that played in school, stopped playing, and then had their families and their careers, and then are like, you know, when you retire, what am I going to do? And one of the things they loved the most was maybe playing their instrument in school. And you see these people coming back. I've had many people come back after 30, 40, 50 years and find their way back into this love. So it is an important part of people's lives.
Well, let's bring in Henry now on the road to Indianapolis, I understand. Henry, hi.
Hi, sorry. On the highway, actually heading for Milwaukee first.
Okay.
But, just want to mention, I'm sort of what she's talking about. I had played in college. My dad was an orchestra conductor, my grandfather too, and played in orchestras, but didn't have a place to play immediately. I've been in public radio all my life, actually. But then found out at College of DuPage in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, they were forming a one-to-a-part wind ensemble, and I had a month to audition, got in as second flute, and was playing in the Bensonville Wind Ensemble there, and have been playing ever since. Played in, I'm right now in 3 groups in Indianapolis. One that went through the pandemic, we were the group that actually reopened one of the major concert halls in Carmel, the Palladium. We were the experimental group that got involved with, and we were also the group that helped tune the hall when they were working on the acoustics with it originally, but playing in that group, played in the Greenwood Band in Greenwood, Indiana, which was one that we extended our concert season when COVID hit, and then tended to play too many concerts in really cold weather for a while. Also played in the Symphonic Pops in New Orleans. Their conductor's daughter actually plays piccolo in the Seattle Symphony.
Wow.
Played in the Mobile Pops, too. So I've sort of traveled south to north, north to south, back sort of to the Midwest again. Flute and piccolo. So.
Henry, you've caught the bug. I will declare it. Maybe you don't realize that, but I mean, Gail, involved in so, three, right. I think you said, in Indianapolis alone.
Right. Oh, yes. There are people that in my groups who play in every place they can get. I mean, they just, that's what they want to do. You're right. It's a good way to say it, Kate, is that they caught the bug. And it's just such an important part of their life. Another thing that I do is I'm the adult program director of Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp here in Michigan. And we have an adult program that's 30 years old. And we have people that come from all over to revisit that experience they had of being at camp and music and as kids. And the adults get to do it too, but not for as long, not for 2 weeks. They get to do it for 4 days, but still that's enough, you know, to get back into the woods and play with other people and have a good time and meet people from all over. You know, that thing of everybody knows someone 1 to 6, that ratio music. I think in music, it's about 1 to 2. I really, truly believe that because it's worldwide. I got friends everywhere in the world because of being involved with concert bands.
Mm-hmm. Well, practically speaking, how does someone start a community band? How does one start a city band in their community?
Sure. It's really not as difficult as you might think, because if your community has a school band, oftentimes that's where you can find yourself going to them and talking to them. Sometimes that director will want to do something. Perhaps the middle school director, who isn't quite as busy in regards to, you know, high school programs that the high school directors have to do. And they're the ones, because it's a passion within you. It's almost like a religion, you know. It's not something that you just do and you're done with it. It truly is something that people want to do. But you can start talking to that person to help organize. Sometimes I see it done through organizations like VFW, American Legions. They were started that way a lot during the 50s and 60s. A lot of people just get the group of people together. Maybe they start with 10 people and, you know, they started out that way and they rehearse on a Monday night or whatever. And they borrow music perhaps for a while till they can get themselves into an organizational big enough to be able to fund themselves, do concerts and have fun and decide what you want to do with it. Now, ACB has a website and on there it says how to start a community band. And so there's a whole booklet that we have designed to help with people who really, truly would like to do this. Right. So it's on our website.
Well, Gail, so good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Yes. Oh, it's been a thrill. It goes by way too fast. I have so much more I'd love to share. So
next time, Gail Brechting is president of the Association of Concert Bands in her 25th year as conductor of the West Michigan Concert Winds in Muskegon, former band director in Michigan. We go out with more Leroy Anderson's Bugler's Holiday. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.